Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Aussie Politics with Alex. As I say that, it's been almost 2 years since I've uploaded one of these episodes. The podcast kind of fell off for a bit there. I will just give you a quick update on what's happened since I last uploaded an episode. I was always unashamed that this podcast project was always my quarantine thing. And in all honesty, I wasn't really planning on extending it once lockdown ended. So that's why my last episode, from memory, was in late 2021, or maybe it was last year. Either way, it definitely has been a long time. So between then and now, I finished Year 12, I got my HSC, and I'm now at university studying a Bachelor of Law. I won't tell you which university I'm at, because that would be kind of creepy, but yeah, that's your life update from Aussie Politics with Alex. Now, today's topic is one that I'm very passionate about, and I will just kind of... In the past, this podcast has always been ostensibly non-biased. I am myself a bit left-wing. I'm, you know, somewhat Labour-aligned. But I did try and keep the previous podcasts somewhat factual. So this episode will be an explanation, as far as I understand it, of the voice to Parliament. I will try and keep it as, you know, non-biased as possible. But just keep in mind that I am personally pro-voice to Parliament. With that, let's get into the meat of things. So first things first, I think it's important that we talk about the actual wording that will be inserted into the Constitution so that, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of. So this is what we'll be voting on. So when you go into that polling booth and you get it'll be slightly yellow ballot paper, not like the ones you get for a federal election, it will read, so the question that you'll be asked, this won't be in the Constitution, it will say, a proposed law to alter the Constitution to recognise the First Peoples of Australia by establishing an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice. Do you approve this proposed alteration? This was introduced by Albanese at the Garma Festival, this wording for the question, and that's basically it. That's what will be on your ballot paper. And then the actual wording that will be inserted into the Constitution is very simple. So this will be, it will say Chapter 9, Recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Peoples, 129 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice. In recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as the First Peoples of Australia, 1. There shall be a body to be called the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice. The Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, 2. The Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice may make representations to the Parliament and the Executive Government of the Commonwealth on matters relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. 3. The Parliament shall, subject to this Constitution, have power to make laws with respect to matters relating to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice, including its composition, functions, powers, and procedures. That's it. That's, if the referendum gets up, that's all that will be in the Constitution. I think the really important part to this is that Article 2 really states that the power of the voice is limited at its base level to matters exclusively related to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. That's what it says. That's all it will have the legal authority to do. And then 3, it really asserts the primacy of Parliament. That's always been part of the Westminster system, that it will have the power to regulate the Torres Strait Islander voice, you know, including its composition, functions, powers, and procedures. So beyond this base level, the Parliament really can tinker around whatever it wants. It can change things up that aren't working, it can modify, it can fix, it can change. And again, it really asserts that the Parliament remains the top dog in our constitutional order, if that makes sense. So the voice of Parliament in its current format kind of originated from the Uluru Statement from the Heart. I know that there was a long history of Indigenous activism towards, you know, greater representation in Parliament before then, including, I believe in the 20th century, there was an Aboriginal activist actually took a petition signed by local Aboriginal people to the King of the UK at the time, asking for a treaty with Indigenous people of Australia. Now, correct me if I'm wrong on that, but it was something along those lines. But of course, that's not what's up for debate these days. So the Uluru Statement from the Heart was a document signed by delegates from 250 Aboriginal delegates from across the country on what they wanted from the federal government. And when Albanese won the election in 2022, he committed to the Uluru Statement from the Heart in full. So the first term agenda for this is implementing the first part of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, which is the voice to Parliament. For those of you who haven't read the Ulrich Statement from the Heart, I highly recommend you do. It's really quite short, because there's been a lot of fear-mongering about this recently. You know, Albanese has been asked in Parliament, or he hasn't read the full Ulrich Statement from the Heart, which, you know, it's a 1.5-page document, the full, the part that was signed at Uluru. And it's really, really a beautifully written document. So I'll just read out the last paragraph of that, because I think it's really powerful. We seek... In 1967, we were counted. In 2017, we seek to be heard. We leave base camp and start our trek across this vast country. We invite you to walk with us in a movement of the Australian people for a better future. Now, I'll just keep in mind that I'm not an Indigenous person, but I am strongly pro-voice to Parliament. So, basically, the way that this was created was there were a number of regional dialogues, you know, so-called forums for discussion across Australia. They happened, you know, in big cities such as Sydney and Melbourne, but there were also ones in smaller regional centres such as the Torres Strait, you know, Dubbo, Broome, all sorts of places across the country. So this is really, you know, showcasing that this did come from Aboriginal people. Now, one of the things that I've come across in everyday life is people arguing that this isn't something that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people want, that they don't want a voice to Parliament. You know, while I'm sure that there are, you know, there will never be 100% agreement on any issue. You know, I imagine getting 100% of English people to agree on one thing. But I think this is the two polls that have been done recently have both shown about 80% of Indigenous people in favour of the voice. So that's just one bit of information that I think is important to put out there. That Indigenous people, you know, truly are in favour of an Indigenous voice to Parliament. Now, the other argument that I've heard recently as well is that, you know, it's too dangerous to put a voice to Parliament in the Constitution, and that rather it should be legislated. Now, the problem with that is that we actually have had Indigenous advisory bodies in the past. You know, ATSIC is a great example of this. Like, it was a legislated body that gave advice from Aboriginal people to Parliament, and it was around for a while. Before it was defunded and then eventually scrapped by Scott Morrison under the Liberals. So this, I think that's really a persuasive argument as to why it needs to be enshrined in the Constitution. Because, you know, the voice department very well at its inception, if the referendum gets up, might not work as well as it could. And the fact that it's in the Constitution means that we have to keep working on it, that we have to keep tinkering around the edges, that we have to keep, you know, improving the way that the voice operates. And the way that the words that are going to be inserted into the Constitution are framed really allows for that. Because while it gives certainty that there has to be a voice, that there has to be a voice with the power to provide representations to the Parliament and to executive government, it also retains the supremacy and primacy of Parliament to almost regulate the voice. Now, I believe that in the words that it can modify the composition and procedures of the voice, but it can't get rid of it. And that's really the key of this referendum, because it will provide certainty that there will be an Indigenous voice to Parliament and that we can really start addressing these issues that are so prevalent in modern day Australia. So now let's talk a little bit about the history of referenda in Australia. Now that's one thing that I have heard. It always irks me a bit in the media when people get this wrong, and I might very well make this mistake. It's that it is referenda, not referendums. So in Australia, there have been, I believe, 44 referendums, right? And only 8 of those have been passed. So it is a tall order for a referendum, you know, to get up to change the Australian Constitution. Out of those 8 referendums, I believe all 8 of them were bipartisan, which doesn't bode well considering that the Liberals and the Nationals are both against this referendum. But there's always hope, you know. Either way, we'll put that aside for a moment. One of the things that gives me significant hope is that the most successful referendum in Australian history was the 1967 referendum, which allowed Aboriginal people to be counted in the census. I was listening to another podcast, I think it was The Party Room, which is an ABC podcast, that said that that's a common misconception, and that one of the other things that referendum did was it gave the Commonwealth the power to legislate on behalf of Aboriginal people, basically moving the issue of how Aboriginal people would be treated legally from the states to the federal government, which allowed, you know, more universal action to be taken, you know, on behalf and for the betterment of Aboriginal people. So for a referendum to get up in Australia, you need to meet a double majority. It's sometimes called double jeopardy in the media. So basically, you know, Australia has 6 states, and you need to meet 2 tests. One, there needs to be, out of all the voters in Australia, you know, I think there's about however many registered voters are in Australia, you need to get a majority of those. So 50% plus one. That's the first test. The second test is a little bit more difficult. It's that when Australia's constitution was drafted, they wanted to make sure that the small states couldn't be overpowered by the big states. And one of the ways that they did this was that for the constitution to be changed, it requires a majority of four states, as well as the majority of all the electors. So, you know, we very well could imagine a scenario where, you know, the two most populous states, New South Wales and Victoria, both voted for yes in extreme margins, like 90% plus. Hypothetically, of course. And then all the other states voted no by smaller margins. Obviously, in that scenario, the referendum would have a majority support of the popular vote. But it wouldn't pass and become part of our constitution because it doesn't meet that second test of receiving a majority of votes. So it is a really high bar. This is the other argument that I've heard recently, that it's dangerous to change our constitution, that it's a threat to our democracy, and that our constitution should be left untouched as much as possible. And I have a bit of a problem with this. And the reason why is because if the argument that people make is that the constitution should never be changed, it's too dangerous, that the framers who wrote this constitution envisioned it to be set in stone, it can be kind of unraveled by like a single proposition, is that if the framers intended for the constitution to never be changed or modified, then they wouldn't have included a way of changing the document within the document itself. So just a bit of reflection there for people who believe that, you know. Of course, we haven't had a referendum for a while in Australia. I think the last one was the Republic referendum in 1999, but that's a little bit beside the point. So now I'm just going to go into a little bit of the detail of what the voice of parliament would look like. Obviously, this isn't what we're voting on, but when, you know, a lot of the studies were carried into the voice, they came up with a set of design principles, which is just some basic notions on what the voice of parliament would look like. So basically, it would be a permanent body that would have the ability to make representations to the Australian Parliament and the executive government on legislation and policy that has to be significant to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. This isn't in the design principles, but it would further the self-determination of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people by giving them a greater say on matters that affects them. So this is actually in line with the UN Convention on the Rights of Indigenous People. That might not be the name, but it's something along those lines. And in that, one of the articles is that Indigenous people should have the right to self-determination and within their own country. And that's one of the main goals of the voice to parliament. So these are design principles. One, the voice will give independent advice to the parliament and the government. So this advice would be relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. The voice would be able to make these representations proactively, meaning that it didn't have to be asked to consult. Then the voice would also be able to respond to requests for representation. So it could also go the other way. The parliament would be able to, you know, give, you know, you could say write a letter to the voice, and the voice could get back to parliament on advice that it needed on legislation. The voice would also have its own resources to allow it to research, develop, and make representations. This prevents the issue that happened with ATSIC from it being defunded. The parliament and the executive government should seek representations in writing from the voice early in development of proposed laws and policies, obviously that affect Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. B is a really important one, is that the voice will be chosen by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people based on the wishes of local communities. The voice really is a bottom-up initiative, in that it's meant to be very close. It's meant to provide on-the-ground assistance. You know, while it doesn't have a program delivery function, it's meant to be very in touch with the issues and addressing those issues on a grassroots level. These members of the voice would be selected by communities and not appointed by the executive government, say, like, you know, how the High Court is. This would be an elected body. So it's accountable, you know, to the people, as well as electable to some other structures we'll get to soon. So the members who were elected would serve on the voice for a fixed period of time, you know, kind of like our politicians, although that can be, you know, not always a fixed period of time. And this is to ensure accountability to their communities, meaning that if, you know, these members don't do a good job, like sometimes our politicians do, they can be voted out. And, you know, ideally you'd have, you know, new, better representatives put in. And to ensure cultural legitimacy, the way that members of the voice are chosen would suit the wishes of local communities and would be determined through the post-referendum process. And that's kind of what I was talking about before, that, you know, we'll be able to tinker with it as we go. If it's not working, we can change it, and we'll keep changing it until it works. So C is that it will be representative, you know, these communities. It will be gender balanced, and it will include youth. You know, a lot of the issues that we've heard about in the past directly involve youth. And it's important that they have a voice, you know, as part of the voice to Parliament. The members would be chosen from each of the states, territories, and the Torres Strait Islanders. So, you know, local, regional, all sorts of representatives. And it would also have, you know, designated remote representatives, as well as representation for Torres Strait Islanders who live on the mainland. So it's really achieving representation across all dynamics. And then the members will also be chosen from each of the states and territories. So you're getting a real spectrum of advice. It will be empowering, community-led, inclusive, respectful, and culturally informed. So, you know, it would be part of the job of being a member of The Voice to connect with and reflect the wishes of the communities. And it would consult with grassroots communities and regional entities to ensure its representations are informed by their experience, including the experience of those who have been historically excluded from participation. E is the really important one, is that The Voice will be accountable and transparent. The Voice would be subject to standard governance and reporting requirements to ensure transparency and accountability. You know, we might very well, like, you know, these members would be accountable in most of the ways that democratic institutions are accountable. This is the crucial one, is that Voice members would fall within the scope of the National Anti-Corruption Commission. So, you know how occasionally we have, you know, ICAC inquiries, as happened with Gladys Berejiklian. If there's, you know, corruption or anything like concerns about conflicts of interest within The Voice, they would be able to be dealt with by the National Anti-Corruption Commission. It's not, you know, a third chamber of parliament. It will be accountable, and it will be accountable to legal processes. And these Voice members would be able to be removed for misconduct. In almost in that way, it's a stricter benchmark than our politicians have to face. The Voice would also respect the work of existing institutions, and it will not have a program delivery function, and it will not have a veto power. So those are some of the concerns that I know a lot of people have. It won't have a veto power over a government legislation, and it will not have a program delivery function. So while it is, you know, predominantly, I mean, it's almost exclusively an advisory body, the important thing to note is that, you know, a good government who wants to take the advice of Indigenous people would be very brave to ignore the voice to Parliament. So just some information to put out there. And then in the book that I'm reading, there's also some FAQs. So some questions are like, would The Voice be able to interfere in matters that aren't obviously affecting Indigenous peoples? And to that, you know, The Voice will focus on matters that affect the health and well-being of Indigenous people. That's what it's there for. That's who it will be made up of. And that's, you know, its main function. And that's really it. It's not a scary change. We've passed much more scary referendums than this in the past. This is, you know, an advisory body. It won't have any power to change stuff on its own. It needs to work through the existing democratic processes and, you know, the accountability measures that we've already set up. You know, in 1977, I believe it was, we made it so that our judges had to retire at age 75. In my view, that's a much larger change than The Voice to Parliament. This is really just allowing, you know, if I might borrow some of the phrasing from the Uluru Statement from the Heart, it's really allowing people to take their own rightful place in their own country and to, you know, help improve the lives and outcomes of their people and to make Australia a better place. That's really all it's about. So in my view, there's no need to be frightened. It's been worked on by a lot of people. Legally, it's very safe. We've had a lot of noted constitutional scholars, you know, come out and say that it's legally safe. You know, so when the referendum working group was being drafted, there was also a panel of constitutional legal experts, you know, names such as Greg Craven, Megan Davis, Noel Pearson, Anne Twomey, who's a personal hero of mine, all basically, that's it. Their job was to answer legal questions that come from the working group, and their job was to advise the referendum question and the constitutional amendment. So these eminent constitutional experts drafted the words that we inserted into the constitution to ensure that, you know, the intention of providing an advisory, not a third chamber of parliament, body to be inserted into the constitution won't have any unforeseen consequences, you know, with high court challenges and whatnot, expanding the power of The Voice. Like, it's airtight. These are the most eminent constitutional professors in the country, and it's as airtight as it really can be. The other thing that I did want to mention, I've uploaded this a little bit late, is that today, as I'm recording on the 18th, this is a Monday, if you haven't enrolled to vote already, you're actually too late. The bar in the eastern states, I should say, closed at 8 p.m. today. I'm not sure of the intricacies of that, but you can look into the AEC website for more information, or to find your local polling place if you have enrolled to vote. And you know, this is a it's a really big deal. I wasn't old enough to vote, obviously, in 1999. This is the first referendum that I'll be voting in, and I'm really looking forward to casting my vote in, you know, what whichever way the referendum goes will be a defining moment in the history of Australia. So I think just in closing, a lot of people are really nervous of The Voice, and I understand that because change is scary. But I think if you talk to people, most Australians understand that the current approach isn't working. You know, we spend vast sums of money trying to improve outcomes of The Voice of Indigenous people. And The Voice, like, if the current approach isn't working, we need to try something new. And I think that's what's the most persuasive argument of The Voice, is that it will, you know, by, if you want advice from a group of people, you ask them about it, you engage with them. And it will enable us to, the money that we're already spending will be better directed, and hopefully we'll get better outcomes. And if we don't, we'll change it, we'll modify it, and we'll keep improving it until we do. So I really encourage you all, you know, to go out there, go read, go get a copy of the Voice to Parliament handbook. I really enjoyed reading it, and it made me feel a lot more comfortable with the proposed change to the Constitution. This is the other thing. If I've made any mistakes in the recording of this podcast, I've really tried not to. I've tried to go from, like, you know, reputable sources. Just feel free to send me, like, you my Instagram, Aussie Politics with Alex. You can send me a DM on there, or you can send me a voice note through, it's not Anchor anymore, since that's how long it's been, through Spotify for Podcasters, and I'll make a follow-up to this if there's that many that I see, like, the need to correct some misconceptions, and I'll make any corrections to this podcast that, you know, needs to be out there. So I hope you've enjoyed listening. That was Aussie Politics with Alex. If you've enjoyed listening, make sure you like and follow, subscribe on whatever podcast platform. I think Spotify and Apple Podcasts are the ones that people tend to use. Give me a positive review. Share this podcast with others if it helped you. And if this episode gets, like, you know, a good level of engagement, I'll go out there again and I'll keep making these, and we'll see how it goes. Maybe I can bring this back in the future. So I hope you've enjoyed listening, and I'll see you next time. Stay safe, everyone. Bye.